Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Talking Stocks. It's what we do. Today, I am excited because I'm joined by Max Chatsko, lead advisor at Seven Investing, to talk biotech, and more specifically, the pros and the cons of existing and future approaches to treating disease, including gene editing. Max, welcome to the show today.
Hey, Todd. Thanks for having me here. I'm really excited.
Yeah, I'm absolutely thrilled to be able to dig into some of the pros and the cons associated with gene editing in particular. There's just so much exciting stuff occurring in research right now. And a lot of people have very, very high hopes for gene editing and what it may do for, you know, a lot of these really tough to treat diseases where there aren't a lot of good solutions out there. Max, a lot of the people who are tuning in today probably aren't that familiar with, you know, the differences between, say, the existing kind of treatments that are out there, small molecules like aspirin or something like that, you know, monoclonal antibodies, say like the PD-1 inhibitors, if you will, gene therapies out there like the Brigatart-targeting CAR Ts, and then of course gene editing, which is kind of like going to be our focus today. And I was hoping that maybe you could kick off the show by providing just a little bit of a, you know, background for those listeners on how gene editing differs from these existing approaches.
Yeah, so, you know, there's small molecules, like you said, aspirin, and then there's biologic drugs, so mostly antibodies, but also gene therapies or cell therapies. Maybe for this discussion, it's best to kind of look at it a slightly different way. So we have genetic medicines, and then we kind of have like everything else. Genetic medicines work on DNA or RNA, and they try to affect gene expression before proteins are made. And then everything else kind of works on either proteins, inhibiting them, affecting their function, or mopping up the molecular messes that they make downstream. So if you just think of the central dogma of biology, it's pretty simple. This is in biology 101 courses all across the world. It's that DNA makes RNA, RNA makes proteins. So DNA, RNA, proteins. And that's why we call DNA and RNA the information molecules. Genetic medicines give us for the first time the ability to act on DNA and RNA. And then so instead of mopping up proteins or what happens afterwards, we can actually maybe stop them from being produced or fix a mutation or add a mutation that's beneficial so that the right proteins are being made or mutated proteins are being avoided from being made. So much more targeted way to treat diseases and encourage health.
Why haven't we been able to do that yet, Max? I mean, what is it about our genes that is so complex that makes it so tough? I mean, you know, we've got these, obviously there are limitations that are associated with, you know, the small molecule drugs. There are limitations associated with monoclonal antibodies. I mean, they don't work in everybody. And maybe we have some antibodies built up to some of the, you know, the like the AAVs or, you know, the adeno-associated viruses and stuff that are used. Why is it so hard to crack the nut, if you will, in being able to figure out how to tinker with our DNA to be able to, you know, cure some of these, you know, genetic diseases? I mean, there's thousands of genetic diseases out right there, and, you know, yet we're still struggling in treating many of them.
A lot of it comes down to just the complexity of biology, and that's kept us from having very precise and accurate tools. So for genetic medicines, you know, we have things like RNA interference, RNAi. We have things like gene therapy. Now we have a lot of gene editing tools as well. You know, we've had antisense oligos. So for those, it's just kind of tough to really perfectly map onto the sequence of RNA or DNA that we're trying to affect. Sometimes it's tough to bind to DNA or RNA and have an effect, get into the right cells that we need to. You know, if you have a gene that's causing your disease and it's only expressed in your liver, well, then we have to get that drug to your liver, right? And then for other genes, the gene expression might be very broad. It might be in multiple tissues. So if we get a genetic medicine into your liver, that might only actually impact, you know, 20% or half of all of the protein expression that you have in your body, because we're only getting into one of the tissues or the genes expressed. So we're still kind of developing all these tools for how do we target tissues very specifically? How do we escape immune responses? Like you said, you know, a lot of these have maybe some immunogenicity attached to them. So it's triggering immune responses that make the therapy less effective. And then sometimes means we can't redose the therapy. it's actually the limitation of gene therapies. You know, I think like a lot of investors or people out there, you know, we talk of gene therapies being like a one and done treatment, but that's actually not because of convenience. It's actually it's not a feature of gene therapy. It's actually a bug, if you want to use that analogy. It's because your immune system creates neutralizing antibodies to the payload. So then if we try to dose you again, it wouldn't be effective. It might even be more harmful due to toxicity issues. So a lot of complex factors to take into account. But yeah, the most important issues are delivery, accuracy and specificity for trying to get to the right sequences of DNA or RNA. And then we just haven't had the tools, you know, to use those. But advances in sequencing and, chemistry synthesis and things like that, really improving at a pretty rapid pace. So it's kind of putting all these things in play now.
Yeah, I think it's hard to believe given how much news flow there has been, that just how recently it's been since we've actually mapped the human genome, and really started to be able to dive in deep enough to have enough information from enough people to really come to some specific conclusions.
Yeah, and until recently, actually, like I think just in the last year, we actually hadn't looked at about 7 to 10% of the full human genome sequence. Those were dark regions. They were inaccessible with our current, sequencing tools and technologies like those from Illumina. So we actually had to invent new tools to be able to read the rest of the genome. So we actually only recently know all of the base pairs and all of the sequence of the human genome.
Right. I mean, so much of that research was occurring just in the short reads, right? It's only very recently, to your point, that we have kind of this longer read technology, right? And yes, some of that was expense, time, expense, lack of the technology itself.
Right. Yeah. So there's different sequencing tools. Right. There's a short read from Illumina. There's long read from PacBio. There's actually an even longer read called Nanopore sequencing from Oxford Nanopore. And then there's a lot of startups and other companies working within those verticals and tools, and actually some newer emerging DNA sequencing technologies that are out there as well.
We're only really getting to scratching the surface, I think, on being able to actually truly understand, how genes interact and cause disease. I mean, we're only, again, within the last 5 or 10 years to the point where we can really test and test people and say, okay, yeah, you actually have this genetic type of cancer or whatever. And then be able to draw some conclusions based on that and be able to say, okay, well, maybe this is the drug that you should, or this is the treatment you should take for whatever particular, mutation you happen to have. But I think that kind of, naturally lends itself to talk a little bit about, what we're seeing going on right now. You're talking about gene editing, and there are other types of gene editing. I mean, obviously, zinc finger has been around forever, right? Sangamo has been trying. I mean, I remember press releases from the early 2000s talking about their research into HIV, and we're still waiting to see something like that pan out in clinic, but they're still at it. And I know they're doing some interesting things with Pfizer in hemophilia, but I think that might actually be, I'm not sure if that's zinc finger, if they're using AAVs for that. I have to go back and take a look. We're also seeing Valrox from BioMarin, but again, that's more gene therapy where you're expressing what you need to express for the clotting factor, I think in the liver using some sort of a fetal version of it. But you're now seeing this clinical trials kicking off, and starting to get data from some of these CRISPR-Cas plays. And maybe that's, you can steer me in a different direction, but obviously that's the one that seems to have caught in most people's attention over the last 3 years, right? It's almost like when in 2000, maybe 15 or 14, 15, something like that, we really, really started focusing on CAR T therapies, right? Getting really excited about CAR T therapies. And Max, you probably remember, we had Kite fighting against Juno, fighting against Bluebird, and all that. So I mean, I think it would be kind of cool to kind of talk a little bit about CRISPR-Cas, where we are now, especially given Intellia had some news earlier this year that got people all sorts of excited about the potential of doing in vivo versus ex vivo gene editing. And yeah, so I mean, if you wanted to talk a little bit about that, that'd be awesome.
It threw a lot at me there. But yeah, there's a lot of, let's start from the top if I can remember. So there's a lot of different therapeutic modalities within, like under the umbrella of gene editing. So obviously there's CRISPR, but there's also other enzyme systems, enzymatic systems. So there's ARCUS nucleases, right? So we have CRISPR gene editing. We have ARCUS gene editing. We also have TALEN gene editing. And actually, we also have all of those things can be used in base editing as well. So we have CRISPR base editing. We also have ARCUS base editing and TALEN base editing. And there's other systems as well. So the enzymatic systems of gene editing and base editing are, you know, well established in terms of the minds of investors, but they're still earlier in terms of development, right? I think, you know, Cellectis has a TALEN, they're the TALEN company. They just recently unveiled their, you know, ambitions to use, you know, some of those base editing tools with their systems. Typically, they've only been using, you know, the gene editors to make cell therapies. So there's that. You have to think of there's different types of tools that are out there, right? There's also different kinds of gene editing tools that aren't just enzymatic. These are still like mostly from startups, but there's different ways to edit RNA or DNA that doesn't use enzymatic systems, or we take advantage of certain natural processes that are already within cells. So we don't have to actually introduce something like Cas9, which is a foreign enzyme, right? We recruit enzymes that are already within cells to maybe add genetic material or make edits to genes that way. So there's all, you know, CRISPR's kind of put everything on the map, I think, in terms of getting the ball rolling. But then, you know, this is how technology progresses. There's always advantages and disadvantages to all these tools. So new tools emerge when they say, okay, we can keep most of these advantages or maybe even improve upon them, but we got rid of or mitigated this other disadvantage or these disadvantages here. So a lot of excitement right now in the CRISPR stocks and CRISPR space. I don't think that's the last word, but certainly very exciting. You know, I'm generally optimistic about all of these things, not just in gene editing, but genetic medicines. And I think just maybe right now in the market, there's some valuations are a little ahead of themselves in certain areas. So
we've got different players out there just from the CRISPR space alone that jumped to mind, right? We've got Caribou, which I think is founded by Jennifer Doudna, who is one of the people who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2020. We've got Editas, you know, which was, I think, I can never pronounce it. I'll let you pronounce.
Feng Zhang's lab.
Feng Zhang's lab. Right. And they're doing some interesting things, treating a rare pediatric form of blindness with some data coming out soon. We've got Intellia, which we already hinted at, is doing some interesting things, maybe sickle cell, I think, and beta thalassemia. So there are a number of different players out there in the CRISPR cast. Maybe that's why a lot of people are focusing their attention on this from an investment perspective, because we're finally starting to see, okay, we're going to start getting phase 1, phase 2 data. And, you know, I mean, biotech investing is risky, right, Max? I think you and I are 100% in agreement probably on the binary risk associated with this industry. Listeners, 90% of drugs that enter clinical trials end up in laboratory dustbins, you know, so only 10% that go into phase 1 actually make it through an FDA approval and get to market. And then a whole nother ball of wax, right, to try and commercialize these and make money on them. And with the gene editing, we still have no idea how this is going to play out. Some of the gene therapies too. So idea how this is going to play out in the form of cost to the system, payers, and to consumers. I mean, some of the chatter out there, for example, some of the drugs that are in development, thinking about biomarins, you know, you could see $2-3 million because you're able to get rid of the prophylaxis infusions in that indication. So they're thinking, okay, well, maybe we can charge $2-3 million for a treatment that we really don't know how durable it would be. And I think that this is part of the question too, is like, how durable can gene editing be, right? And then what kind of risks, because we are, no matter what we do, some people that have historically have not responded to drugs. Other people have had horrible side effects to drugs. I mean, we have to consider, you know, what can go wrong too. I think a lot of times as optimistic investors, we think to ourselves, oh, we see data on 2 patients from this early stage phase 1, and we start making all sorts of crazy extrapolations to how this is going to be, you know, the best way to treat it. And it could very well be that that's gene editing may have a very specific use case, but it may be better to use something else than gene editing. What do you think of that?
Yeah, no, that's right. So, you know, we can use Intellia Therapeutics as a good example and just discuss some of the context and nuance. So Intellia has both an ex vivo pipeline. So that's when you're using gene editing to engineer cell therapies. So the cell therapy is the actual therapeutic, but we're using CRISPR more as a tool in the lab. And then they have an in vivo pipeline as well, which is where CRISPR is the actual therapeutic. So you're actually injecting that or administering that into patients, and it's going into a patient's cells in their own body and making genetic edits for whatever various outcomes and objectives that they have. So in June, Intellia Therapeutics announced the first ever in vivo CRISPR-Cas gene editing data. And they had preliminary results from a phase one trial. So it's still ongoing.
Yeah, I think that was an ATTR. I said the wrong indication earlier, right?
But it was right. I didn't catch it. But yeah, so that was in a rare genetic disease. Hereditary ATTR. I don't know how to, what the rest of those funny letters stand for. We have too many acronyms in our head, probably, Todd.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a misfolding, the buildup of the misfolded proteins in the organs with a very poor prognosis. So there's absolutely a big need for
safety. Right. So if you inherit a mutation in this gene, that protein, transthyretin, is misfolded. And then it, instead of shuttling what it's supposed to do in the body, shuttling vitamin A around in the body, rather, it accumulates, it gets sticky and it attaches to organs. It can cause plaques in your heart. It can clog up other organs. So if you can either correct that protein, that mutation, then it can serve its proper function in the body. You can also just knock out or reduce the expression of that gene through gene silencing tools so that levels of that protein are much reduced. So there's different ways to do gene silencing. You can do temporary gene silencing, which is something like maybe antisense oligos or maybe RNA interference, or you can do permanent gene silencing, which would maybe be something like gene editing, right? And so Intellia Therapeutics is using, it's knocking out the TTR gene in a patient's liver. So it showed in June that it could effectively, efficiently deliver this. So it's administered through an intravenous infusion, IV, and then it does get delivered into the liver, and it apparently, based on the protein levels that they were observing afterwards, after 28 days, it does seem to have an effect. It does reduce those protein levels of the TTR gene that we can detect in the blood. So that's good. And everybody got really, really, really excited about it. All CRISPR stocks kind of popped on that news. Intellia Therapeutics is now worth, maybe, I think it was like $12 billion or something last I checked, which is a little bit frothy, maybe.
12.2. And just to go back in the way back machine, I think Kite Therapeutics was taken out for 11.9 or 10.8. Juno went for 10.8. So you're talking about higher than the takeover valuations of the CAR T developers. But yeah, continue, please.
Yeah. So now if we think about just this one disease, hereditary ATTR, and why would you want to use permanent, or maybe why would you want to use temporary tools? And I think a lot of investors might think, oh, well, if you can permanently fix it, like we throw this C word around, cures, this is a cure. And there's reasons that maybe you don't want to throw that around. So A, I think this should be a durable response. And that's because in this specific disease, the TTR gene is actually only expressed really in certain regions in your brain and in your liver. So if you can knock out gene expression in the liver, then there's no other tissues that are going to be secreting that protein into the bloodstream. So if you permanently knock it out in the liver, it's probably permanently knocked out for good everywhere, right? Now, the problem, though, is that the TTR gene, and this is true for everything, you're going to have to, in this space, you need to always consider the context and nuance, and it gets kind of complicated pretty quickly. Every gene tends to play multiple roles within the body. So yes, that mutated TTR gene does misfold and accumulate and cause these diseases, right? Where you have amyloid buildup, so like scarring of tissues. But the TTR protein is the only molecule that shuttles vitamin A around in the human body. So we need vitamin A for vision. And so in fact, if you knock out, if you silence that gene, whether it's through RNAi or through CRISPR-Cas, gene editing, those patients permanently for the rest of their lives need to take daily vitamin A supplements. And they also have, oftentimes night blindness, so they can't see at night or in low levels of light. There are other consequences. It's not like a perfect cure because you're not actually correcting the mutation and allowing TTR, to play its natural biological role. So as excited as everybody is, and like this was really good data, relatively clean. There's actually one point I might want to bring up, but that was exciting because it was a relatively low dose. We didn't see any immediate safety signals like immunogenicity, so no triggering of immune responses. And they achieved their objective. Basically, they showed that they could reduce expression of that gene and reduce levels of that mutated protein. So that was good. But obviously, there's like things they can do better, right? Maybe eventually we could precisely correct that mutation so that we preserve levels of, you know, TTR in the body instead of just making it reduced. That would be the most beneficial for patients. Correcting errors is always better than just deleting the function of that gene.
Right. I was thinking about, you know, if you go back to some of the just small molecule stuff, you can add more drug or remove more drug to get right. the desired effect that you want. And gene editing, it's kind of like, no, we're literally cutting out that, you know, mutated portion or whatever. But I mean, there were two things I wanted to get a little deeper on with that with you. And one was, are you concerned at all about the double-stranded breaks? You know, the fact that you're cutting in the and potentially with the repair, could you get cancers or something down the road because of that? And are you worried at all about the off-target risk? And again, not so big of a deal here, because like you said, you know, it's pretty localized on where that gene production is. So just curious if you had any opinions or thoughts on those two issues, because I think that's something that investors are going to want to be paying attention to.
Yeah, so I'm going to take those in reverse. Are off-target effects a worry? And here, I think not. I think that made a lot of noise in terms of a risk of gene editing, and it is a risk. But that all comes down to designing more efficient guide RNAs, really. So if you can design a guide RNA, is how you target the payload to that specific spot on the genome. So Intellia can just design very specific guide RNAs that mostly only match that sequence of the TTR gene that they're after, which means the payload eventually ends up exactly at that spot on the genome. So I think we made some pretty big progress there, and I don't see that being a major risk in terms of off-target effects. The bigger risk is the on-target effects, which is your second question about double-stranded breaks. So this first generation gene editing tool, which anything based on like the Cas9s or any of the Cas enzymes really, and there's others, also Talens and Arcus also require double-stranded breaks. So a double-stranded break is, you know, everyone's seen like the double helix DNA structure, right? We're all familiar with that, pop culture, movies, whatever, right? Exactly. So CRISPR gene editing and other gene editing modalities currently work by making double-stranded breaks to the DNA. So they cut the DNA right in half. There's risks, and then they just rely on natural cell repair mechanisms to stitch it back up together after the edit has been made, whatever that is. It's a knockout, it's adding something. And the problem there is that there's some errors in some of those processes. So there's two different types of DNA repair mechanisms that come into play for these tools. The first is non-homologous end joining, or NHEJ. And that's what this tool from Intellia uses. There's also homology-directed repair, which is HDR. Now, both of them have pros and cons, and we won't get too far in the weeds, but they both allow you to edit genes at different parts of the cell process. So some of those have more advantages than others. NHEJ seems to be more advantage, but it's also more error prone. It can make errors when it's repairing the DNA. And also important to note that this knockout from Intellia is not actually that precise. So CRISPR-Cas enzyme gene editing actually works by causing indel mutations. So it knocked out that gene by inserting or deleting random genetic material within a certain sequence of the TTR gene. So that's it. Just disabled that gene from being read. It's still in the genome technically, but by inserting random genetic material, it disables that gene. So not as precise as maybe the next generation tools, like maybe base editing, where you can go in and just snipe out one base. So you're not adding or changing anything necessarily.
Beam is working on that, I think, right?
Yeah, there's Beam Therapeutics and Verve Therapeutics, for example, are two of the companies working there. So indel mutations can be a risk. And also, a double-stranded break is that's the most traumatic event in biology, right? I mean, that's how cancers arise. That's how mutations arise. And we have observed, at least in the lab, that and in certain animal models as well, making double-stranded breaks does lead to some really not good things, things that we typically associate with cancer. So inserting random genetic material, deleting random genetic material. And also, if cuts are made, you know, if a sequence is cut in such a way that there's a chunk of DNA floating around, that can actually lead to multiple repairs, multiple cuts and repairs being made that you don't have control over. And that can lead to something called chromosomal rearrangements. So all of those things are hallmarks of cancer. So in my mind, I don't think making double-stranded breaks, any of the tools that rely on that, whether it's CRISPR or Arcus or Talens, I don't think that's really going to be acceptable in the long run. And it does concern me, again, with Intellia being, you know, a $12 plus billion company right now, all of its tools right now that are in the clinic or in discovery stages are using double-stranded breaks. I think eventually everyone's going to have to transition to base editing or other gene editing strategies that that don't make double-stranded breaks. And it's very interesting, Todd, when you see, like, if you look at the base editors and there's other like startups that are working with nothing to do with CRISPR, but editing the genome or RNA in some way, all the companies that don't make double-stranded breaks are very, very quick to point that out in all of their marketing materials or their SEC filings. So it's certainly a concern within the scientific field among, you know, academics and researchers. So I just don't think it's going to be a worthwhile risk. Because again, like you said, there's no undo button when you're making permanent changes to the genome. The tools we have now, like what Intellia is using, isn't not very precise because it is makes random breaks and random insertions and deletions. And, you know, what happens
if you didn't want to go back later and have to try and correct your mistake
5 or 10 years from now? What happens if, you know, there's a problem? We say, oops, sorry. That's just the price you pay for progress. I think we already have better tools now to get around some of that. Now, I'm sure some people might point out Intellia is working on base editors as well. It's only actually used those in ex vivo cell therapy. But there's no real reason that other companies, anyone else, can't develop base editors. So that's good news. But it would certainly hit the reset button on the pipeline, I think.
Well, and I think that's something that people have to keep in mind. And, you know, obviously, I always try to keep my enthusiasm in check. Like my first reaction is, wow, this is exciting for humankind, right? And is it advanced? I think it could potentially advance us in a certain direction. There's certainly a lot of money flowing into these. Thank you, stock market, right? Funding these companies that's allowing them to be able to do some of this fantastic research. But the first generation approach to gene editing may not be the one that truly is the one that unlocks the potential of gene editing itself, right?
Right. You know, yeah. Go ahead. Oh,
I was just going to go on the cast. We're going to kind of move into that cast thing and talk about some of the you know, how it could be evolving from here. But I just wanted to say that. So yes, I am optimistic about, you know, some of the advances, and we're going to get some over the course of next year, listeners. We're going to get a lot of data from phase 1 trials. From all four, I think all four of the companies that I mentioned, so Caribou, Editas, CRISPR, and whatever the other one is that's jumping my mind now, but we're going to see data from all of them over the course of next year. And there's the potential, obviously, for them to report data from relatively small samples and say, this is great, and for us to be optimistic about that. I would just also, to piggyback what Max was saying, rein in just a little bit of enthusiasm, because we could have other solutions, next generation solutions coming that may be better. And if we do end up noticing, or their concerns get raised by the FDA, we've seen this with Valrox, with BioMarin pushing off their approval multiple times now at the FDA, there could be questions about, you know, maybe we need 5 or 10 year safety data before we can introduce this to a more commonly seen disease. I mean, obviously, if it's an extremely rare disease where there's no treatment options and it's the prognosis is horrible, well, then maybe you get to market. You know, I'm thinking something like a DMD or an Alzheimer's, where maybe the FDA is willing to jump the shark a little bit to get something out there.
Yeah, that's important that you bring that up, because a lot of these gene editing companies are going after rare diseases. But increasingly, that doesn't mean they have no treatments. You know, there's a ton of overlap right now between a lot of the gene editing pipelines for the in vivo tools anyway, and RNA interference, right? Ooh. So with Intellia Therapeutics, everyone brings it up, the comparison to Onpattro, which is a RNAi drug from Alnylam Pharmaceuticals. And everyone makes, rightfully so, the comparison that points out how inconvenient Onpattro is, right? It's, you have to be administered through an IV every 3 weeks. So obviously it's, they call it, this is like a term that the CRISPR companies came up with, which I love. They call it chronic treatments to draw the distinction between their one and done approach. So these chronic treatments, in air quotes, like Onpattro, right? Oh, it's so inconvenient every 3 weeks. And that's right. But what a lot of people miss is that the comparison is actually not to Onpattro. That was the first and only RNAi drug approved by the FDA that used the prior generation RNAi tools, right? So that's actually encapsulated in lipid nanoparticles. And the whole field's moved beyond that now. Nobody uses lipid nanoparticles for RNAi. So that's why it has to be administered through an IV. There's actually next generation approaches, or I guess current generation might be the best way to put it. And there's actually a drug that's already been submitted to the FDA from Alnylam. It's the next generation drug for treating hATTR. It's called Vutrisiran. I think the FDA has a PDUFA date on April 14th, 2022. It's most likely going to get approved. It actually beat Onpattro in its clinical trials, if you can compare those anyway, you know, head to head. But importantly, it's because it doesn't use lipid nanoparticles, we can actually deliver it subcutaneously. So a simple shot. And right now, at least within the approval application, they're asking for it to be dosed once every 3 months. So it's much more convenient than once every 3 weeks. Additionally, they think they can actually bump that out to once every 6 months. So that'd be even more convenient, right? Twice a year, you have to go to your doctor anyway, if you have a rare disease, just get a shot, and it's pretty simple and straightforward. It's also reversible or not permanent. So that has its advantages again. And additionally, Alnylam Pharmaceuticals has a third generation RNAi platform called Icaria. And they're thinking that this can enable RNAi to be dosed once every 12 months. So once a year, and you would get efficient knockdown of the TTR gene. And also they have a way to make it reversible in case there was some worrisome safety signal they observed. So that's actually an important component of that next generation platform. And their first target for that platform is actually hATTR. So the companies that are, you know, in the competitive landscape see gene editing, and you know, they're responding as best they can. You know, RNAi is limited to gene silencing, right? Gene editing is not. They can have other approaches. It's not just about knockouts or anything like that, disabling genes, right? They can knock in genetic material, they can insert genetic material, and so forth. But you know, RNAi, I think, can go after certain diseases where maybe they do have an advantage. So things you don't want to make permanent edits to the genome for, like maybe alcoholism. You only want to treat that within a certain treatment window, right? Within so many years. And obviously that would be coupled with, like therapy, right? But you don't want to necessarily make permanent edits to a genome just to treat alcoholism or other types of addiction. Same with maybe depression, right? You don't always want to make permanent edits to a genome. So there's enough like white space for all of these genetic medicines to add value on a case-by-case basis. But I do think that there is like one genetic medicine that's ideal for each disease. And it's not always RNAi, and it's not always CRISPR. And it's so there's always, you know, again, there's so much context and nuance to remember when it comes to all of these diseases.
Yeah. And when you brought up the RNAi, it was one of the things that made me think about, like, again, you have all of these different competitors within that are doing things at similar times. And I already talked a little bit about the CAR T, where you had, you know, multiple CAR T players advancing at the same time. And Juno had this big setback. I remember its shares got really hit, and that was phase two. And so there's, it made me think, when you were talking about RNA, it made me think of Arrowhead and some of the problems Arrowhead had had, and it, you know, derailing its RNAi program. And then you're just going back to, you know, Alnylam, and thinking that symbol there, listeners, if you want to pull up a chart on, is ALNY. You know, I just looked at the chart longer term, and yeah, it's been a great stock to own since 2004, but there are huge periods of time where you suffered massive drawdowns, you know, as there were the natural waves and the progression of their drug through clinic. And, you know, you look at, like, at one point in the mid 2000s, the stock was trading at $35, and it got all the way down to $6 from 35 at one point in 2011. And you do yet another drawdown where it got up to 137 and fell all the way to almost $30. So, you know, extrapolating a straight line to when the science could be very not a straight line,
could be
a little risky.
This is actually a great case study too for genetic medicines, because there's actually a lot of parallels perhaps to CRISPR gene editing. So, you know, RNAi won the Nobel Prize, just like CRISPR gene editing did. RNAi actually won it though in physiology or medicine. CRISPR-Cas9 won it in chemistry. So more of a nod to its broader use outside of medicine as well. But for, you know, there's a ton of excitement in the mid-2000s over RNAi. There was companies getting snapped up for over $1 billion in like 2005 and six. I think Sierna Therapeutics was was bought, you know, and Alnylam had an IPO and it was doing amazing. There was all the big companies, Roche. I don't remember all the specific names, but all the largest drug developers were like forming partnerships, making acquisitions, getting involved, because it's the first time really that, you know, we could make changes to DNA or RNA. Right. And after the setback just 6 years prior in gene therapy, people were really excited to get back into genetic medicines again. But then things started to go off the rails a little bit because they overlooked, you know, how things in animal models don't always translate into humans, or things in early stage human trials don't always translate into mid and late stage trials. So the issues with that first generation approach of RNAi was actually that they used lipid nanoparticles to deliver the therapeutic payloads, which is what Onpattro uses from our discussion just a few minutes ago. And that just led to too much immunogenic responses. So it triggered immune responses in patients. You needed much higher doses. It didn't actually get to the liver very efficiently. It accumulated other tissues, a whole host of things that went off the rails, right? So that really crushed all the enthusiasm for the field. Alnylam went around and consolidated all of the technology. There was a company I mentioned, Sierna Therapeutics, got acquired for $1 billion. And then later on, what remained of it, or all of the IP, was acquired by Alnylam for like 150 million or something like that. Great deal for them. But Alnylam had to go back to the drawing board and figure out, how do we actually deliver these medicines to where they need to go? And for most of them, it's the liver, right? That's where most gene expression is occurring for a lot of these diseases. So they went out and developed a new technology where they made, it's called oligoconjugates. So conjugate just means you're linking the therapeutic payload to some other molecule called a ligand. And that ligand matches up perfectly, or about as well as you can, with a receptor on cells in a very specific tissue. So they invented GalNAc, which is a sugar that has a high affinity for receptors that are expressed on liver cells. So if you conjugate oligo-GalNAc conjugates, right, you can deliver anything to liver very well. And that's why RNAi is just kind of taking off recently. So all these next generation tools, when you have a conjugate, you can just you know, deliver very effectively to any tissue you want, assuming you have the right ligand. So right now, RNAi is only really in the liver, but all these companies have other platforms and ideas for, well, instead of using GalNAc, what else can we attach to the payload if we want to get it to the heart or the lung or adipose tissues, fat tissues, any other tissues where there's gene expression occurring. So there's some really interesting tools and technologies going on there, but it's very interesting. You see the initial hype and excitement, and then the oh man, everything crashes and they have to go back to the drawing board and really hammer it out. But once they figure it out, it really works very well. And in fact, I think some of the CRISPR companies, even though they're encapsulating their enzymatic payloads into lipid nanoparticles, they're actually using GalNAc as a conjugate to get it into the liver. So interesting to see how, you know, Alnylam kind of paved the way there for everybody. And now conjugate research is very, you know, it's a cutthroat field right now. Everybody's trying to find the best ways to, deliver payloads to different places. But again, there's a lot of parallels, all right? CRISPR won the Nobel Prize, lots of excitement. You know, you get some initially great data, there's all these partnerships. But what happens if maybe double-stranded breaks become an issue, right? I mean, I think all it takes is one company to really screw it up or get some worrisome data, and the FDA could put a clinical hold on the whole field, which would be pretty, not a good day to be an investor necessarily, right? And it might force other innovations, things we don't know right now, to be invented and overcome. So.
Right. And I mean, a lot of times when it comes to these risky areas where I tend to take a basket approach, you know, because it's like, I don't know who the winner will be. Will be in RNA? Will it be Ionis, or will it be Alnylam, or will it be Arrowhead, or which wasn't, or will it be, you know, which one? So you kind of can sprinkle the infield and not bet all on one horse, if you will. Of course, there's upsides and downsides to that. I mean, I you know, if you were going to Well, I guess what we would say here, based upon what you were just discussing, is that if you think about a baseball game, RNA AI is much more advanced than it would be for gene editing, other gene editing tools like CRISPR-Cas or something like that. Maybe now we're into the commercialization phase. We're going to see a lot more exciting stuff reaching the market in RNA because it's just, it's more developed. It's had more time to mature. They've, like you said, they've been able to pivot and find the right solutions to their problems, and hopefully no new problems emerging at this point in the development. But that's actually RNA research here. That's what was going on in the 90s, wasn't it? I mean, when it first really started to, people started to really talk about it. So, I mean, I think a lot of times we want to have things happen right away, right? As investors, we want to say, okay, they had this great phase one readout, or they have this really interesting preclinical thing. And then, you know, we want to see that start to, you know, get to the FDA for a PDUFA date within the span of 2 months, but, you know, like more realistically like 2 or 3 years. But when the reality is, it's more like, well, if you're talking about commercialization, RNA way more advanced than say, other gene editing like CRISPR-Cas, which is could still be, I mean, you're only in phase one in these things. You could still be what, 5-6 years away from even thinking about, I don't know. What do
yeah,
you think?
Yeah, and RNAi, so yeah, the research I think that led to the Nobel Prize was done in like 96, 98, something like that. So it does take time. Now, I mean, the pace of innovation and, yeah. and how quickly we can work has accelerated quite a bit. So I don't think we'll have to wait necessarily decades. We could see, you know, some CRISPR or some gene editing tools in general maybe hit the market before the end of this decade, right? In vivo tools, I'm saying specifically. But yeah, you're right.
What's further back? What's like, what would be further back? So if you say, okay, you know, RNA, Y, and then you say CRISPR-Cas maybe in this second or third, what's warming up? What's in the pregame, you know, stages?
Oh, I see. What's on deck in the batting
circle?
Yeah, what's
on deck, if you will?
Yeah, I'll keep using your baseball puns. So yeah, I mean, so like CRISPR gene editing would be like, well, let's remove CRISPR because I want to be careful to know that there's exactly. other tools. So if we look under the umbrella, that's just called gene editing. Any tools that use double-stranded breaks, that's kind of the first generation tools. The second generation tools would be base editing. So it's not making a double-stranded break, and it maybe can enable more precise repairs of certain mutations, limited by the types of edits you can make though. And it has to bind to very specific sequences within a gene. So there's another limitation. And then the third generation tools might be prime editing, kind of combines all the best features and bells and whistles that you want from you know, the first gen and second gen tools. Doesn't make double-stranded breaks, but it's still in the early stages of development. There's one startup in particular called Prime Medicines working with CRISPR, you know, prime editing. There's reasons that we can maybe use other tools other than CRISPR to have prime editing as well. One of the biggest drawbacks though, is it's massive payload. It has two enzymes in it. So trying to encapsulate that into a lipid nanoparticle and then deliver it into cells and a lot of things that can go wrong are really tricky to try to encapsulate these payloads as they get larger and larger. Base editing, for instance, so actually, as you go down, first generation, second generation, third generation, all of those payloads get larger as you move on. So any ways we can maybe simplify the payloads would certainly help in terms of maybe allowing them to be safer, more effective, having lower doses, you know, all things that are good for patients.
Most of those companies are probably not public yet, I would assume, if you're looking really, really, you know, far back at who's maybe warming up in the bullpen or whatnot, whatever, however we want to go with this metaphor.
Yeah, so you have they're under the stadium in the cages still, all right? So you have, yeah, I mean for base editing, there are companies that are public. Obviously, there's the CRISPR base editing companies like Beam Therapeutics and Verve Therapeutics. Verve actually has borrowed a lot of its technology from Beam. Beam has the opt-in rights to all of Verve's programs. But this is actually a good example. So, again, I love the technology. I kind of hate the valuations, though. It's kind of become a momentum stock, both of those, actually, for that matter. But
Verve, just looking it up, symbol there, VERV. Listeners, if you want to look at it, we're valued at $3.4 billion right now. And yes. We've also been talking a little about Beam Therapeutics. Beam Therapeutics, wow, valued at $7.6 billion.
Yeah. So like if there is a problem with double-stranded breaks, I imagine those two stocks are going to have a lot of money inflowing into them. But you know, for Verve Therapeutics, they're going after, at first, they're trying to work on, you know, different like lipids, cholesterols, things like that. So things, diseases that have validated genetic targets. So we already know that it's probably going to work if as long as you can meet your objective. They have really, really great and clean data from some non-human primate studies. That tends to translate pretty well, I think, for these therapeutic modalities into human studies. And so initially, you're going to work on some rare diseases. So like rare inherited diseases where you have mutations that don't allow you to process or keep your lipid levels in check, right? So not very large populations necessarily, but then they eventually want to walk down into larger patient populations. So like maybe anyone that has a cardiovascular risk or high lipid levels, right? Maybe you can go and get this therapeutic later. So that's an interesting approach in terms of gene editing, right? And it's a unique opportunity if we think of the biomarkers that it's trying to affect or control. And in this instance, I do think permanent editing makes more sense than RNAi tools or something that's not permanent, assuming, of course, it works and it's safe and effective. But I kind of do like that approach better. Like, so there are all the RNAi companies are working on these, you know, cardiometabolic diseases as well, the same exact genetic targets as Verve. But I really do think, you know, something like a base editor makes more sense in this specific indication. And actually, I just talked myself into reminding myself about, you're talking about, you know, how long it might take for some of these like tools to hit the market or, you know, we're still pretty much in the early innings. And this is important to consider as well. I mean, the FDA is in no rush to approve these treatments, right? Because although they're going after rare diseases, there's often an increasingly safe, effective, and convenient treatments already on the market. I mean, you know, in hATTR, patients are going to have Onpattro, which is admittedly less convenient, but very likely starting next year, they're going to have Utrasiren as well, whatever that gets branded as. And that's going to be on the market for many years longer before, you know, Intellia Therapeutics has a chance to maybe launch its drug candidate, assuming it gets approved. Onanem already has global commercial infrastructure, you know, and if you can dose that once every 6 months and maybe later once, you know, less frequently than that, I mean, at some point that's convenient enough, you know? And if you're
And if you have doctors who've been prescribing and it's working for their patients in controlling and managing the disease,
would you
want to even switch to a one and done that's probably going to cost millions of dollars and that you may still have some, I'm not sure about 5 or 10 years down the road, question marks. So I think
So, you know, there might be some skepticism or, you know, hesitancy, I should say rather, to using those permanent tools since we don't know what's going to happen later. They're going to have established tools that are very safe, effective, and convenient. And Alnylam has been publishing data left and right. They just actually published new data this morning from Utrasiren, and they're seeing signs that it reverses disease. So where your body actually has time to clear, you know, those misfolded proteins and get rid of the scarring that's occurred in your tissue. So more data like that. I mean, it's going to be hard to dislodge that. I think it's more likely that, you know, we'll see more pricing competition because on island prices, it like on Patra is like, I don't remember. It's like $600,000+
probably $500,000+, right?
Yeah. I'm sure Utrasiren will be priced similarly. So if a CRISPR tool or another gene editing tool, it's something, you know, gets approved, on island will probably have to reduce its prices. So that's good for patients. But man, it's going to be tough to dislodge that treatment in that disease specifically.
But it seems like all of these different gene editing companies are focusing, at least initially, on slightly different areas. Max, you've been incredibly generous with your time on today's show. I just want to, before we wrap up the episode, I just want to give people things to look at here over the course of the next year in the gene editing space. I hinted at this earlier. We are going to see a pretty good amount of news flow coming that will move these stocks. I mean, for good or bad, these stocks are going to move based on whatever the data happens to say over the course of the next year. CRISPR Therapeutics is expecting to have some sickle cell disease and beta thalassemia information in 2022 from their trial, which they expect to be fully enrolled this year. They also expect later this year to report some insight into their study in T cell lymphoma. Over at Intellia, more ATTR data on tap to maybe compare against what Max was talking about with Alnylam. Editas is going to have some LCA10, which again is that rare form of blindness in children. They have said next month, and I think their press release when they released that in August. So that could be coming at any time, I think, if it hasn't already been released. So that's something to keep an eye on. And then Caribou, I don't think there's anything on the near-term horizon on them right now. But those are some of the things we want to be watching.
Yeah, and there's also Graphite Bio is another CRISPR company. I have no idea if they have anything going on there. I think they're using, they're trying to use CRISPR to make a precise site in the genome to then insert genes and genetic material. So different from gene therapy, where you don't have control over the location. It's a lot like real estate, location, location, location. Genomes are the same way. Yeah. So in gene therapy, you don't have control over the location when you're making insertions. And that's why we don't actually insert genetic material into your genome with gene therapy. It's encapsulated and just exists in the cell outside of your genome. But with CRISPR or other gene editing tools, potentially you could have control over that location. So they're using those tools in that way. Intellia actually has a pipeline or tools doing the same thing. So Graphite Bio, another one. Then the base editing companies like Beam and Verve as well. Arcus, what is it called? Precision Bioscience always trips me up. They're using Arcus nucleases. And then, you have Selectus, which is maybe a little too ambitious. Talent. It's not very well funded. And Talents have some advantages in engineering blood cells and specifically. So we'll see from there. There's a ton of other.
One thing's for sure, right, Max, is it's never a dull moment in biotech. And I would say one of the things that's really, because of all the advances in the last decade, how much money got thrown at the cancer moonshot and all these other things were done over the past decade. So much money has been committed from venture capital toward these. There's thousands now. It seems like we were joking before the show. There's a new biotech IPOing every 4 hours, it's seemingly. So it is a very tough space to stay on top of. And it's all moving much, much more quickly than it did a decade ago, to your point earlier. I mean, we probably will get slightly more compressed research and development relative to what we saw in previous generations. But hopefully our listeners feel a little bit smarter after listening to us prattle on about gene editing. I'm sure they also have plenty of questions. So Max, if they want to find you online right now, go to 7Investing. They want to call you on your phone. Go to 7investing.com. Max and my friends over there at 7Investing doing some awesome, awesome deep dive stock picks. I really highly recommend them. I am a subscriber. So feel free. And Max, how can they reach you on Twitter if they want to follow you on Twitter for more of your insight?
Don't follow me on Twitter. Leave me alone. No, at 7, the number 7, and then my name, Max Chatsko. And that's spelled all kinds of funny ways. But if you look at 7Investing, you can find me there somewhere, I'm sure.
Fantastic. And Max, thank you again for taking your time today to talk to us all things biotech. Hopefully you'll come on the show again.
Absolutely, man. This was good. Thanks.
All right. Great. Bye-bye.